Sarah Wheeler has written about her travels in Antarctica and down the length of Chile, and in her latest book, she moves to the top of the Northern Hemisphere, describing her journeys above the Arctic Circle in Russia, Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and the island of Spitsbergen. She traveled by air, land, and sea, visiting scientific observatories and tribal peoples in remote cities like Anadir, Kangerlussuaq, I think it's pronounced, or something like that, and also Murmansk. The Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased to welcome Sarah Wheeler to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You call the Arctic an indistinct geographical zone. What's indistinct about it?
Well, nobody exactly knows what it is, where it starts and where it ends. And, of course, this is in complete contrast to the Antarctic, which is a continent, so no problem there. But there's a lot of interest involved in defining the Arctic. For example, if you're a Scandinavian farmer, you believe very strongly that it starts very far to the south, because then you're going to get the EU Arctic farming subsidies. If you're a Russian oil minister, you believe it starts quite far to the north, because that means that you get more of the slice of the action when it comes to drilling for hydrocarbons. So I really took as my starting point the Arctic Circle. Many people take the tree line, but the trouble with that is it does tend to go up and down awfully, so you get into a terrible muddle knowing whether you're in the Arctic or not. So broadly speaking, I take the Arctic as the Arctic Circle, and everything above that was of interest to me.
It is also just an ocean surrounded by continents, but the ice keeps on changing its size too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The Arctic Ocean, which, as you say, is a huge part of the landmass, the mass at the top of the Earth there, is very protean, always has been. This is not just a new thing to do with global warming, changing its shape and size and thickness every year. So it's all very, it's that the whole region is in flux constantly. And of course, it's moved to the centre of the stage of public consciousness, international consciousness lately, largely as a result of global warming. And we're all a lot more interested in it now than we used to be. It was a region for a long time that everybody forgot all about. But now it's become the kind of central thing of global warming. And of course, polar bears are its poster boys. So a lot of people up there terribly interested in the extent of ice, for example, of the Arctic Ocean. And not least because, and this is very germane now with the trouble in the Middle East, we know there's an awful lot of hydrocarbons locked underneath the ice. As the ice melts out, it's easier to get at it. Hence, a lot of the squabbling among nations, including your own, about who owns what and who has the rights to what. And we're going to
because we have to to some degree, our boundaries are beyond the continental shelf, and there's disagreement as to how far out you can actually go, isn't there?
Exactly. I mean, technically, you're right that if your continental shelf extends to 400 miles, then you've got drilling rights over those 400 miles. But how far your continental shelf extends, of course, is open to debate. And I don't know about you, Leonard, but I sort of feel if you pay someone to do research, if you pay them enough, they'll come up with the answers you want.
Of course.
And there are geological teams from all nations up there at the moment proving that continental shelves either extend or don't. And of course, it's not at all straightforward. Even Google Earth can't tell us that. It's a long way down. Those waters are very cold. It's very hard. So an awful lot of dispute. Then you've got things like the Northwest Passage, where the dispute there is about, are these international waterways or are they national waterways?
Because for the first time, we actually can go what the Europeans were looking for, which was to go across the Atlantic to get to Asia. You can actually do it now. You don't have to go down to the Panama Canal.
You can actually cut
through this, although you need a bit of an icebreaker.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it was the Holy Grail going back to the 16th century because it was a shortcut to the riches of Cathay. And now, most summers, this is the thing, it depends from summer to summer because of the ice. Most summers, you can get all the way through. And that's become also, so I found constantly in my travels around the Arctic that it was occluded in mystery, controversy, doubt, drama. And in a way, it's an area that's always been shrouded in myth. And in the way that countries have dealt with their Arctic Norths, it's often been a story of unintended consequences. And in a way, I found that, from a writer's point of view, full of potential. Because after all, you know, I think as you get older, the only thing you know is that there's no black and white, there's only grey. And the Arctic really is the embodiment of that kind of issue of doubt.
I thought it was all white up there. But you have traveled to the bottom of the planet for two of your previous books. Did you find any similarities other than the fact that there's a lot of snow and a lot of cold when you went to the north?
Well, of course, once it gets to a certain level of cold, everywhere's the same because you're just concentrating on trying to keep warm in a sleeping bag.
And most people like to vacation in warm, sunny climes.
Yeah, it's
you
true.
You tend to go to cold places.
I know. People are always asking me about that. But you have to understand that those landscapes, which are completely untainted by the human hand, really are desperately beguiling. And I think when you've seen the Northern Lights or seen sea ice shimmering in the mist, then you really can understand that uplift. But the answer to your question is, to me, the differences are more significant than the similarities. And I think I first became aware of that when I stood on a remote and uninhabited Russian island, which is part of the Franz Josef Land archipelago. And I heard sounds that were very similar to the sounds I'd heard in the Antarctic, which is the clinking of ice platelets and the polar wind and lots of different ice noises. And I suddenly heard a bird singing, a songbird singing. It was a snow bunting. And, of course, there are no songbirds in the Antarctic because it's too remote for migratory birds. And that really brought the Arctic to life to me, and it's what really crystallised for me the difference between the two places. The Arctic is about life. And the song, the snow bunting that was chirping there in the ice really made me see this is the difference because the Arctic is about people. And really I set off in my book to sort of write the biography, if you like, of the Arctic, but I got waylaid much more than I had intended to by the human story.
Well, there are people in the southern tip of Chile and in Argentina, aren't they?
Yeah, but that's not the Antarctic continent, which, as you know, is 1.5 times bigger than the United States, and there's no indigenous people at all.
My guest is Sarah Wheeler. Her latest book, The Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle, published by Farris, Straus and Giroux. Now, what about the Magnetic North? Aren't there a whole bunch of North Poles?
Oh, absolutely, masses, untold numbers. And there's even the celestial North Pole, which is up in the sky, which sort of moves around. And the magnetic North Pole also moves around. There's five North Poles, and the celestial one makes it six. But, of course, the one at 90 North never really changes that much, and there's no land there.
And the magnetic North Pole keeps on changing?
The magnetic North Pole moves around, yeah. I think at the moment it's just off Alaska.
What happens on the South Pole? Does it stay in the same place?
The South Pole, well, the trouble at the South Pole where I've been at 90 South is that the spot of land at 90 South would stay in the same place, does stay in the same place, but there's half a mile of ice on top of it, and the ice is sliding around like anything. So it's very difficult to draw a straight line from that 90 South. And there's someone who works for the USGS who has, I think, one of the best jobs in the world, which is to move the marker at 90 that says South Pole every year a few inches, reflecting that the marker pole is in ice and the ice has slid because basically the ice, as you know, sort of is all coming off like icing off a wedding cake. And somebody goes there and officially moves. And I think that would be a pretty cool thing to tell people that you did for a living.
Now, you mentioned that it is beautiful and pristine, but is it really pristine? It's not just covered with white ice and snow. There are all these polluting things happening up there. And the worst, you say, is the Russian nickel-producing city of Norilsk. What are they doing up there, and why do they have to be in the Arctic Circle to produce nickel?
Well, because that's where the hard rock mines are. That's where the minerals are. I mean, it's incredibly rich in minerals and hard rock stuff. And I'm afraid when it comes to those inland Russian Arctic industrial plants, we don't know the half of it. Because it's only if the wind's blowing in the right direction that the monitoring stations in Sweden can even have a glimpse of what they're doing, and they are closed to foreigners. You're right, there's masses of very serious contaminant problems in the Arctic, but you can't see most of them. For example, in the Arctic Ocean, the most serious problems of pollution are in the marine food chain. All kinds of chemicals that we banned here in the 70s, those ghastly things that were in flame retardants and so on.
PCBs.
Get into the marine food chain because they're not water soluble, they're lipid soluble. So they like things with a lot of mammals with a lot of fat. And of course, that tends to be polar mammals, seals and so on, have really high content of these toxins. And indigenous peoples at the top of the food chain, some of them are much more polluted than any of us who live near the source of pollutants. So it's something that scientists call the Arctic paradox, that many of the people who live furthest away from the source of pollutants are the most contaminated. And I think that's an all too real symbol of the way that we in southern latitudes have inflicted our own hungers and greeds and needs on the indigenous peoples up there.
But we also find a tenth of the world's oil and a quarter of the gas up there, and they've been finding other things as well. Is the place being invaded by prospectors who are looking for diamonds and other and some of the rare minerals?
Yeah, I think invaded might be a bit strong, but there's certainly lots of people going up there and all sorts of controversy all the time, as you've experienced yourself here with the problem of Alaska and how many licenses are going to be granted.
And we had the Exxon Valdez spill, which I'm sure is still causing trouble.
It's still causing trouble. That has not worked its way out. And, of course, the cleanup of that was a tremendous PR coup because, in fact, the reality was there was a lot of destruction that was never cleaned up. There's a lot of controversy in Greenland where you mentioned diamonds. There's a lot of diamond and garnet mines, or that geologists have found potential mines, and Greenlanders granting licenses, and a great hoo and cry amongst the environmentalists as this shouldn't be allowed. But I put it to you, the Greenlanders are having a struggle and a battle towards independence from Denmark, which they want. Now, how are they going to get that if they can't realise their own resources, as we have? So it's not at all straightforward, and I hear lots of stories about how we should be doing this and that and the other to save the Arctic from an environmental point of view, which, of course, I would very much hope that we could do. But we also must consider the needs of the indigenous peoples, and I saw that conflict play itself out all over the place.
Well, what is life like for the indigenous people in the past? Most of them were nomadic, weren't they? Are they still living the old life? Are the Laplanders still herding reindeer and moving across vast expanses?
Well, yes and no. They've all been dragged into the cash economy. Really, progress can only go in one direction. And nobody's really a nomad anymore because it's nationhood is inimical to being a nomad. You've got to really have a number and an address and social security number and all the rest of it, otherwise the nation can't function. So there aren't really any nomads. In Russia, where there's 17 separate, completely separate different groups of polar peoples, they have all been forced to really be sedentary. In Lapland, you mentioned, there are semi-nomadic reindeer herders.
The Sami, or Laps.
And I spent some time with them, and they twice a year do bring all the reindeer down from the mountain at the end of summer and then back up again. And they do make a precarious living out of reindeer herding, but most of them have to do other work also. It's quite a marginalised existence.
Now, we're talking about Inuit people, aren't we? Are they all pretty much the same people? Did they start in Siberia or wherever and then cross the land bridge into Alaska and then wind up moving all around up there, or did they come from other places?
Well, that was going quite a long way back, the events you're talking about, maybe 11,000 years. I suppose you could say they had the same origins, but just like you and I did, and people listening might be thinking that we sound pretty different.
Well, you're British. That's the only reason. Otherwise, we're exactly the same.
Well, I wonder how much that how much that's the case. Except for the Sami, who have partly European roots, and they do look quite different. All the other polar peoples, you're right, are quite closely related, but they all have their own languages, some of which are mutually unintelligible. and they all have their own cultures. Now, most of them are reindeer herders, so they would have a lot of cultural traits in common. Some of them are hunters of marine mammals. So they do have pan-Inuit councils now and so on, and they're trying to consolidate some kind of political power. But as you can imagine, when it comes to the reality of the life that we... the world that we live in, they don't have very much.
You say mosquitoes were a special scourge. I always thought mosquitoes were warm weather insects.
Not really. They have some way of going into cryogenic suspension in the permafrost, and seem to absolutely burst forth at the first when the mercury goes over a certain level. Particularly appalling in Canada, and in the Russian taiga there, just above the tree line, where of course there's lots of stagnant water hanging around when it melts out.
You also talked about people drilling ice cores in Greenland. Mm. How is that done, and what do the ice cores tell scientists?
It's an incredibly difficult thing to do. I reckon that outside of extraplanetary scientific research, it's the most logistically challenging type of science there is. And basically what they're doing is getting out telegraph poles of ice, many, many, many of them, and they can analyze the chunks at the bottom.
They can actually tell how old the ice is?
They can certainly tell how old it is. They can also tell the components inside the bubbles of air trapped inside the ice. They can tell what the formation of the air was then, and therefore they can show what sort of shifts and changes there have been. So
if an asteroid hit Earth and killed off the dinosaurs, as most people believe, we would actually see some of the dust from that collision?
Although they do have a lot of volcanic ash, for example, which is a key indicator. But what they can tell us about the composition of the air and the atmospheric changes is a key component in climate change. So it's really climate change at the sharp end. And we found it a great privilege to be with those people, and it's fantastically hard work.
Do they all agree that the ice cap is melting and that it's irreversible?
Nobody really agrees on anything except perhaps that. I think that they'd say, oh, yes, well, we do all agree that it's melting, it's irreversible. But the important thing is, how fast is it melting and what are the effects going to be? And nobody agrees on that.
Now, you've written biographies and you've written at least three travel books. Well, you've written one about the Greek islands, which is quite different, but three travel books in the north, extreme north and south, the coldest parts of the earth. Are you going to go back to the cold parts again?
Well, my other son, when this Magnetic North was published, he said to me on the day it came out, Mom, how do you feel? And I said, I feel most of all a sense of relief. There's only two poles.
Sarah Wheeler will be speaking with Simon Winchester, another favorite of the show, tonight at 7 o'clock at McNally-Jackson. That's at 52 Prince Street. Tomorrow she will be reading at the FSG Reading Series with Amy Waldman at the Russian Samovar on West 52nd Street at 7 o'clock. For more information and to buy tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, The Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.